This is What's Up ABQ. How you doing, Albuquerque? Man, it is so good to be back. Just so you know, Lindsay and Lorenzo have had, quite a whirlwind of a year since the last episode in, 2022. Lots of stuff has happened, as you may have suspected, but now they're back introducing you to interesting people and places around our beautiful Burque. Beginning our first episode of Season 6, we'll take you to a new coffee shop in Midtown. Sure, catching up over a hot cup of joe is great, but in this episode, Lindsay and Lorenzo talk with the proprietor to discuss almost nothing about coffee and a sobering story of going from the stress of pouring corporate jitter juice to becoming a disillusioned and disappointed small-town cop. Pour yourself some Java and prepare for your eyes to be opened, and not just because of the caffeine. Welcome to part one of this What's Up ABQ.
Hey Albuquerque, this is Lindsay.
This is Lorenzo.
And this is What's Up ABQ.
What's up, Albuquerque? This is Lorenzo.
And this is Lindsay. And today we have a special interview for you. We are interviewing...
Hi, everybody. It's Charles Baca, owner of Burning Daylight Coffee here in Albuquerque.
So, Charles, for people who don't know where you're located, where is your business located? And kind of tell us how you got to this physical spot.
So, actually, this could probably be a show on its own, but we'll shorten it up. When we actually began looking for a place for our establishment, we were looking to neighbor a neighborhood, essentially, and we wanted to do so because we wanted to be that neighborhood coffee shop. And so where we currently are, we were able to achieve that, but the long and dirty of all this was we had looked at four, maybe five locations, and every single one of those locations we had tried to go into, there was actually somebody else competing with us, and as we all know, the cannabis industry had just been, I mean, it's still on the rise, but it's sort of, I feel like, maybe leveling out, but at that time it was still on that really, really peak.
Yeah.
And so we actually ended up losing four potential leases to cannabis.
Oh, wow.
And so we almost questioned, like, okay, is this the right time to enter the market, and is this going to work out? And so,
like a bidding war for the lease, or?
Yeah. So essentially, how it would work is we would call these places that were available with the lease sign up, and essentially what we were getting in return from landlords or agents who were handling or managing the property was that it was, or they would ask us what we were planning on bringing in, so on and so forth. And we would tell them some of the places had actual kitchens, so we thought we'd share the space with the bakery. And so we told them, you know, it was going to be a coffee shop and perhaps a bakery, shared space. And they said, well, you know, great, we love our coffee shops, but we'll let you know. And so they were waiting for us to say, hey, we're in the cannabis industry. We're opening up a cannabis dispensary, or what, so on and so forth. And it fizzled from there. And so coming into the space that we're currently in, how we ended up here was we had everything, as we're recording in the coffee shop, we had everything here that you see, and it was set to go. Basically, we were just sitting on all of this stuff, all the equipment, and we couldn't make any money off of it. And so my parents actually own the family indoor flea market, and my dad, basically, we were sitting there at the table one night and having a cup of coffee, and
no kidding.
you would guess. And so while we were there, he said, you know, you have everything, you've got everything in place business wise it's all structured. He goes, you have your own entrance here. He's like, just open here, get your name out there, and then eventually maybe you can spread your wings and go elsewhere. And when we looked at the space, this place was full of just stuff, and it was very unstructured at the time, and he was already looking at a way to revamp this area, and I saw it as a blank canvas, even though there was so much stuff here. And so we started chipping away at it, and we began with just paint on the walls and then flooring, and then it just kind of took off from there.
So something that's really cool, and it's funny that you mentioned that this like wasn't originally your first choice for a space, because to me, being a patron, I come in here and it seems really natural and it flows really well and it fits really well. And everything, you know, because we've had conversations, you know, obviously not recorded, and we've talked about the different things in this space and how very intentional they are, which I love. And I think that being a customer and coming in here, it's one of those like pleasant bonus surprises that you get. You're like, you know, oh, I'm going to come in and get a cup of coffee, but also I'm in this really cool space that's like an experience. Can you tell us, if you don't mind, a little bit about maybe some of the intentional pieces that are in this space and kind of why you chose them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what people, it's funny because like when you come in here, people are, they kind of look up and they're like, what is this? Like, where am I? Like, they know they came to get coffee, but then they look beyond and it's like, whoa, like there's so much stuff. But as far as like the items that really stick out in this space, for instance, like we wanted to source everything locally. We tried our hardest because we wanted that sort of New Mexico modern feel, but wanted it to have like a lived in feel as well. We didn't want some places you go into, and I love these other places, they're very clean and clean lined and white and
sterile, maybe a little bit.
Oh yeah, perhaps. I think our biggest statement piece, or a couple of them, is, well, for one, our countertop, our counter, our checkout counter, and our service counter, that's actually from the late 1800s, and it actually originated in Cerritos, New Mexico, and it was their original mercantile checkout counter. And I'm still trying to get the photo, but there is a photo of, you know, sacks of flour and sugar and things of that sort that are on top, and there's a barkeep in the back, and there's actually full
He's
a cowboy in full
beans,
right. Yeah. There's a cow. There's an actual cowboy standing in front, full get up, you know, spurs and chaps and the whole thing. But yeah, so that countertop is very historical, and I actually, there is a couple that comes in from Cerritos who comes in and they buy coffee, and I told them where it's from, and he goes, I knew that was the countertop. He goes, I remember that countertop as a kid. He goes, and it was old when I was a kid.
Yeah. So how did you acquire it?
So the way I acquired it was, I didn't know this when I purchased it, but it was for sale on the very, like, if you go onto Craigslist and you look at the very, very back pages of things that have been listed for like 6 months, and you just scroll and go to the next page and go to the next page, it just kind of popped up.
Wow.
And it said $300, and I was like, this has to be a scam. This has to be a scam. It's not sold. It's 6 months old. The listing's 6 months old, and it's still available. Like, I just don't understand. And so I ended up writing the person who posted it, and they lived in Piedras. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, it's still available. I have a lot of interest. And I'm going, but it's been listed for 6 months, you know, whatever.
Little did you know it's haunted.
Right. So I ended up sending, I didn't have the means to go pick it up right then and there. And my uncle who lives in Stanley, I said, you have a trailer. I'll pay you. Like, just can you go grab it before anybody else does?
Nice, nice.
That's cool. You have an uncle in Stanley too,
right? Bro. Yeah. So it worked out, and yeah.
So no, it was kind of meant for you.
He actually helped like with a lot of the build out here, but yeah. So he ended up going out there. The person who posted it, they ended up helping him load it up and told him the story, the backstory behind it, and so I started researching it, and I was like, I'm interested now. And so I couldn't find anything. I would look up old mercantiles, but there was nothing that matched this. Well, the gentleman and his wife that came in, he goes, where did you get this? And I told him, I said, you know, I got it from Tejeda's, but the gentleman who I bought it from said it's the original checkout counter from Mercantile in Cerritos. Long story short, he said, I know exactly where that came from. I'm going to tell you. I'm going to take a photo of the outside and so on and so forth. Well, my uncle at the time, he actually saw the photo of this originally posted in the store. And so every now and then we do get the daughter of the gentleman who we bought it from come in, and, you know, she says, oh, so upset that, you know, they were selling it and as cheap as they were. And she goes, but now that I see it in here in the space and it works and it's alive and back to being used for what it was intended for. She goes, I'm not so mad anymore.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
And so they come to appreciate it, and it's awesome. And it is that statement piece. I mean, I've had really outrageous offers for it from people out of state, and it's just like, nope. it's not going anywhere.
It's staying in New Mexico because this is where your home is.
So, and then you look at other pieces that are in here, like the Royal Crown Cola that came out of Dixon. The rug we're sitting over, that's a Navajo rug, nice. Textile. The couch you're sitting on, the leather couch, that's bison leather, and that came from Placitas. I mean,
everything has a story.
Had a story behind it. Just like the Native American statue that's behind you, that's a local piece. I mean, it was from Monty's Cigar Shop, but it's still local. You know, we sourced it all. It's awesome. And it's just one of those things, like even our mural is a local muralist, Adi Espinosa, who's an amazing artist. If you haven't, you know, I'll give her a shout out because she does great work.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's all over the city, and I think she has a few pieces out of state. I could be wrong, but she's kind of all over.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really great stuff in here. This is my first time coming in here. Lindsay's been in a few times.
Yeah. I pretty much live here when I'm not at work. I sleep on that couch sometimes.
Yeah.
He has to kick me out. He's like, you don't live here, nice. Go home.
But it's a great, like, just coming in and my first things that I see are the gas pump, the old gas pump, and then that Texaco sign.
Yeah.
Like really cool. Like you could tell everything has a story. Lindsay was saying your coffee shop sign has a story, but then you kind of like mix like the sort of modern coffee shop sort of vibe. So I think it's great.
It gives me a feel like it's a very warm Route 66 modern, but also there's like this throwback kind of, I can't describe it. You're just going to have to come in and see it. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the idea here is that you should just come in and see it for yourself. I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit. Obviously you own a coffee shop now, you're doing coffee. Coffee's your thing. Mm-hmm. How did you get started? How did your love of coffee start? And tell us a little bit about your professional history before coffee.
My professional history starts with coffee, and it's kind of, my first job was a lifeguard, but that was summer and that was a kid. And, you know, I think I was 15 when I started lifeguarding. And so that was fun, but it was kind of a job that you did as a kid and that's what you did. And it was great. And I have some highlights of that period of time in my life, but I didn't really get serious about coffee. So I initially started with Starbucks, like most people do in their...
We both worked at Starbucks.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
It's
so
like the rite of passage.
Right.
When you, like,
and so I actually initiation. Right. And so I ended up working at I don't know if you remember this location, but it was the Rio Grande and I-40 location.
Oh, yeah.
But it was back when it was in the strip mall.
Oh.
It's not the one where it's currently at. It was.
Okay.
It was
by, have a conversation well, later because you probably worked with my old manager.
Just that was
who
the
was your old manager?
Christine.
Ooh, I don't.
Would have been 2003, 2004, maybe.
I remember Rachel for some reason.
Huh? Yeah. I mean, who knows? I mean, it's.
But
all
I could
Starbucks
be. I could be
family.
Wrong.
Yeah. They're all interchangeable.
Christine,
at some
Rachel, if you're listening to this, I still love you guys. I don't like Starbucks, but but I have a lot to be thankful for, because Starbucks did give me a lot of money. I mean, they gave me my start. And then they did send me to the training, and they did, you know,
is it coffee?
Right,
you
the coffee school,
or is that something else?
I think they changed it when you became it was coffee school for a while, and then I think they changed it to like coffee university or something.
It was coffee university.
Yeah.
And so, but it was that's where I got my start, and I had a really cool crew. But when I first started there, I was so at the anxiety level. You know, you feel like you've never felt the pressure of any job, or you feel.
Yeah.
Like you've never felt the pressure of any job like a barista has behind the coffee bar of Starbucks.
For sure.
Because it was just so high volume and people were like, I want it this way and this and this and this and this, right? And so there was
right
always like
now.
Yeah. And I wanted out in a minute, 30 seconds. And so, you know, you were hustling on that bar, and there was times where I would just be like, somebody, I just want to be, I just want to be I'll be the register. Like, I don't want to be on the coffee bar, like, you know, and
those cups start stacking up.
Right.
You really feel like you start to sweat it a little.
Yeah. And it's funny because now that I'm hiring people, you know, they experience that same anxiety, and it's like, man, if you had stepped back in time 2004 when I started in coffee and you saw those lines and how specific they wanted their drinks, you would have taken your apron off and you would have walked out.
Yeah.
I think we've all had those days.
Absolutely.
There, like, where we were like, this is my last. Yeah. I know it.
Yeah. I worked at the Starbucks in downtown Santa Fe. So I would get the most intense orders. Like, I had this, I remember this, this person had a order. She had it was like a cortada, but with half a honey. So you get the honey packet, and I had to do half a honey, and she would she would know.
Oh yeah.
And then there was a couple weird things, 132 degree latte.
Like, what does that taste like? Like, you know what I mean? Like, are you going to know? You're going to burn your tongue. I had a lady one time, as we go into coffee horror stories.
Yeah.
We'll get back on track, I promise. and I used to work at the Wantabeau location next to the beach zone. And we had a lady who would come in every afternoon, and she would want a extra dry cappuccino, which, if you know what that is, it's essentially like espresso this big and then just foam.
Just a bunch of foam.
Just foam. And she'd sit there and weigh it out in her hand. And if it wasn't dry enough, she'd throw it in the trash and demand that we make it again.
I thought she would throw it at your face or something.
No, and one day she came in and she complained about it. And I chucked it in the trash and I said, I'm not making it again. Yeah. And I walked in the back and I was like, I think I'm done here.
Oh, yeah.
No, but we've all reached that point, right? Like, I mean, because there are some really specific drinks. Like, I think now the current market is like, well, I will remake it. Like, there's no problem in that. I mean, because there is, I mean, always, you know, as the business model goes, customers write all the time. Yeah. And so...
Just say yes.
Right, yeah. Smile and wave and...
And you have, like, the people who, they haven't had their coffee yet, so...
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And so they're more... Right, they're
a little cranky. Raw.
Yeah.
You know, they're still waking up. They're half asleep. And I totally understand that. I've been there.
Yeah.
Totally. We've all been there. But, so I did get my start there. I have a lot to be thankful for. But over the years, obviously, as you get more and more popular, such as Starbucks has, and this is no dig, I mean, there is some over roasting. There is some, you're trying to churn it out and you're trying to get it out to the consumer. And yeah, at this point though, I think that those drinks have become so enriched with flavors and milks and variations.
Well, you're spreading a wide net, and you're not as focused.
Exactly.
As
right? You're trying to basically grab all these people and bottleneck them into this lane, right?
Thus, the Rio Grande Starbucks location moving from that nice little nook they had into a drive-through to capture those I-40 customers, right?
And because essentially that's what they were trying to get out of. It was
coffee.
Right, and people were like, "Well, I don't want to get out of my car." Anyway, I mean, working back there, I thought it was the best location ever. They had a fireplace. You got down, you hung out. They had a nice patio. It was still considered Old Town. And starting there, getting my education there, I didn't really appreciate that until maybe about after my first year of employment, because I was so wound up on, I got to get these out. I got to make it good. I got to do all this. I got to do this step, that step. But really, coffee isn't difficult. And if you can just make it, it's just consistency. And it's following the recipe, sticking to the recipe, and then adding those variations that those customers want. And so eventually going to that coffee university and getting the education, it was like, okay, this is doable. And I actually appreciate the science. But after I appreciated the science, I actually learned to develop that appreciation for those true coffee drinkers who knew exactly, like, could appreciate the taste profiles and flavor profiles in the city. And everybody thinks that, you know, translates acidity to something that's bad. And it's like, no, those are citrus notes. Those are fruit notes. These are all the things that are combined and make up of your drink, the chemistry of that drink. And so after I began to appreciate that, it was like, wow, okay, this is an art. This is an art. This is a craft.
It is an art.
And it was cool to be surrounded by other people who also knew that. And moving past Starbucks, I didn't realize that there was this whole other world of craft coffee outside of Starbucks. You didn't, you know, back then you're thinking, okay, what existed back then? All these little shops didn't really start popping up until we're still in our infancy, I think, in our community culture and community here, as opposed to like Denver. Right. Or
we're not
Seattle,
quite saturated. We're not as saturated as a lot of the bigger cities. So there's still room for that culture to kind of grow and evolve, I think.
And with that variety comes more business, I think, because people now have coffee shops on rotation. They're not getting the same drink every single time, or, you know, but the consistency should still exist, right? Mm-hmm. But going from the world of Starbucks to the world of craft coffee at smaller establishments, it was just like, wow, people are doing really amazing things that Starbucks isn't. It was cool to see that spin, everybody's spin on things, and then see different machines that were more mechanical. You know, seeing that world of coffee evolve into something that was more special, it was just like, it lit a fire within me, and it was just like, I want to be a part of this, yeah. and I want to just continue to be. Yeah. And after my time spent at Starbucks, and I'll tell you how I evolved into the, you know, the other world of coffee that wasn't Starbucks. It was after receiving the training, it was like, okay, here comes management, right? Like, they're going to try and shoo you in to manage these places. And it was just like, I don't want to deal with the same problems I gave my boss as a young university student, you know, and I just don't want to do that. I don't want to be that person that's like, hey, like, where are you? You didn't open up shop. Or, hey, like, you're not here. Like, where are you? You know, I just didn't want to. And then there was a lot of micromanaging going on, and I get it. I mean, you're trying to, these managers
that's
are trying to run
machine. Right, right, it's right. A corporation. Yeah. Yeah.
It's got a, it's a well-oiled machine. It's got to run that way. And so I just didn't want that. And I wanted to be in the coffee. And so I ended
you
up helping
the coffee, not the corporation.
Right, 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 exactly. Yeah. And so I actually ended up like going and helping friends that were like opening coffee shops and doing that sort of stuff, and it was great. Then you saw issues within those companies, and then you're thinking, God, I could do this. But then, you know, at the time, I mean, machines are not cheap.
Oh,
even
yeah.
back then, I mean, they were arm and a leg, and they're even more so now. Luckily, we've reached a point here where we were able to buy, you know, one of those machines that are state-of-the-art and are within the times and offer the consistency that we all, you know, preach in the coffee world. But it wasn't always like that. It was very mechanical, and you had to weigh everything, and you had to time everything, where these machines do it for you now. And so moving forward, I thought, okay, I was studying criminology at UNM. I thought, where do I go from here? Is there really, at that time, I'm thinking, there's not really anything I can do in coffee that's going to make me sufficient amount of funds to live and do all the things I want to do. And so I ended up committing to law enforcement, and I ended up going into the academy. And straight out of the academy, while I was in the academy, I was being recruited. I was in the academy, and I was sponsored by the city of Santa Rosa in New Mexico. And basically, I was hired on for 9 months. And for 9 months, I don't know if you guys know how this works. I don't know that it's the same way, but if you get employed with a smaller agency, they'll actually hire you on. They'll put you through on-the-job training. And then after you go through like a, I think I went through like a 2-week course of on-the-job training, and you're talking people that are carrying guns and batons and pepper spray, right? And this isn't a jab at law enforcement. It's more of just like, whoa, like what were we doing 20 years ago? And 20 years isn't a long time. It's yeah. not. I mean, yeah. you blink. What were we doing where I was actually hired on? I went through a 2-week, maybe a training course, and then I went through another 2 weeks of firearms training and emergency vehicle operations within the department. And then I was basically given a badge and a gun and told, hey, you're commissioned, go on and enforce these laws.
That's like yeah. a Billy the Kid situation.
Right, right, absolutely. And so I still right, yeah. yeah. That's funny. I felt, and I had read many Wild West stories. I mean, I'm a lover of all desert dwelling stories and Wild West stories, and you know, I'm a history buff, but when it comes to the Wild West, but you know, it really did feel like they cut my badge out of a tin can and basically said, hey, there you go, go
on.
Best of luck.
Right.
Yeah.
Wish you well. And you know, they gave me a graveyard shift, and a lot of times you were the only person in a small town working a graveyard shift. Well, I had ambitions of being more than just that, and I was on the street without being a certified officer for 9 months.
Wow.
And so fully enforcing, going into bar fights and going and backing up state police and doing all these things. Well, after that 9 months, I finally had a date where I could go to the academy, where they paid for that academy time. And it was back when you actually stayed at the academy and you lived there, and you got maybe every other weekend out. So after doing my 6 months training at the police academy, I went back to the city of Santa Rosa, started, and while I was in the academy, state police was recruiting me. I had been told that if I left Santa Rosa without, because basically they were sponsoring me.
Right.
They were paying the bill.
So you'd have to repay it, or go, yeah.
I'd have to repay them, or I'd be sued for it, or so on and so forth. They put that fear in me, And so I thought, I can't swap over to State Police.
Santa Rosa's a nice place.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I stuck with it. I stuck with it. And Santa Rosa has a very, very shady history as far as, like, I won't say shady. I think that's the wrong term. I think it's more eerie. There's a lot of, like, tales and there's a lot of Wild West stories and way things were handled back in the day. And
I'm about to go on a deep dive and
yeah.
This no could be Santa Rosa Blue Hole.
Yeah, the Blue Hole, Santa
deep
Rosa.
Deep diving. Right?
Funny story, I lived like 50 feet from Blue Hole. I lived in a house called Blue Hole House. Okay. And but anyway, I ended up spending 4 years in Santa Rosa, but I actually was working with Region 5 Narcotics, where I basically became my primary goal and position was a narcotics officer. And so I was doing undercover buys and I was doing buy bust, where basically you would go buy the drugs and then bust them on scene, and or you would or knock and talks, and I mean all this police jargon. While doing that, I mean I fell in love with that because I was really good at it. Really good at it. But then I'd been in a position where I was actually starting to investigate my own. And it was just like, it's bad when you can almost trust the people on the outside than you can within your ranks. And so it got to the point where I wasn't comfortable. And I ended up leaving that position. And I did so, you know, moderately. I had a position that was becoming available to me as an investigator in Torrance County, and where they were starting a special investigations unit, and they brought me on in order to see to that that unit was actually coming to fruition. Nice. I guess. And so I was one of three on that team, and that team still exists now, and I think they're up to, like, I don't know, I think it's 8 or 9 now, which is cool to see. Well, that county needs it. But
that's where I grew up.
In Torrance County?
Yeah, Moriarty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was, well, half in Santa Fe and then half in
Moriarty.
You're only half a Pinto, then?
I'm only half a Pinto.
All right. Half a Pinto,
I'm half a Pinto, half a demon.
Oh, that's, okay. That sounds like a good combination for a long
time. Yep.
And so, a third of Lobo. I don't know. I'm not good at fractions.
A third of Lobo. I loved working in Torrance County. It's the largest county per square mile in New Mexico, but it's that also had its drawbacks, where it was, we were doing a lot of investigating, doing a lot of undercover buys. I've got to show you some old photos of me back when I was doing that, but in my old,
would we recognize you? Probably
not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. As I evolved in that position, it just got to be this repetitiveness of, like, investigating my own or being aware of things that I didn't necessarily want to be aware of. But
in the world with a different pair of eyes than everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, you're seeing the worst of things.
Have to remember, you're talking to a kid who started at Starbucks his professional career and then was, like, thrown into the world of law enforcement. And then you're going, all these people that I've always idolized and always wanted to be were not these perfect people.
The people you thought they were.
Right. And so it was, and it's false to think that. I mean, we're human, even those officers, and I believe in humanizing the badge, but they are held to a higher standard. And so it got to the point where, you know, I made my mistakes. I'm not going to sit here and go, oh, I was perfect and I just saw from the outside and I had my slip ups and I've done my things, but nothing to the extent of what I was seeing.
Right.
And it got to the point where it was just that, again, that repetitiveness of, I'm now faced with seeing what these people who are within my ranks doing exactly the things that we're charging people for in the world.
It's a whole different weight of that moral responsibility on your shoulders, right, too, I think, because you have a little more of a perception of it.
I'll say this, and I can comfortably say this, is nobody likes a rat, even in law enforcement, even within the ranks. And
universal law, I feel like. Right. Stitches get stitches.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it is. I mean, it's, and maybe sometimes it's unspoken. In my scenario of my world of police, it was just that. It was unspoken. And I can comfortably say that I've stepped out of it and I'm no longer in it, but it is there, and it's false for us to look back and go, well, that doesn't exist. It's wrong of us to sit back and go, well, that's not happening. You know, oh no, it's happening. It's happening. But I was put in this position where my conscience wouldn't let me. I've always been told, as, you know, even growing up, you see something, you say something, you report something, you do this, you do that, and this is the outcome. And be honest, be truthful. And I can say that I've always stood by that throughout my law enforcement career. If I couldn't say something, I often left, and to where I wasn't put in that position where I had to say something, because I understood the rules of law enforcement at that time, and I knew the consequences, or I knew what was to come if somebody knew that you knew, or if somebody speculated that you said something. It's a sad sort of environment to be in, but it's true and it's prevalent. But I ended up leaving there knowing what I knew, and then shortly after, the sheriff who I worked for was indicted, who is still pending charges. I left there to go to another agency. Somebody I had worked with at that time had gone and left to another agency and said, hey, like, you're a great leader, you're a great sergeant, you hold these attributes, I mean, you would fit in well where I'm at, and just come over and
bring some coffee
right? And it's funny because I was the coffee maker at that department. Yeah. And so everybody knew I was the guy to go to for the good coffee. But while I was there, you know, it was, again, we were starting an investigation unit, and I was the sergeant, I was leading a team of guys, and they were good guys. This is also a department where people, I didn't know this at the time, but it was a department that people went to where careers were sort of on their, either they were retiring, which I saw my opportunity as was a place for retirement, or it was somebody whose career was on their last leg. And so you did have people who had spotty histories going to that and doing that sort of stuff, but going to that department
and trying to buy their time into retirement.
Yeah. Or trying to clean their slate or clean their reputation. And by doing good and serving the community and doing all these sorts of things, and everything was fine when I first started there. And long story short, what I had been called in to do and investigate, I ended up investigating the very high top level brass of that department. And I wouldn't say that I was the one doing the investigating, but it was brought to my attention that there were things going on, such as misappropriation of time, claiming hours that weren't, you know, committing time fraud.
I remember that being in the news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was just one of those things where it was just like, you know, it was brought to my attention by somebody I was supervising who just so happened to be seeing it firsthand, and him coming to me and saying, hey, we have an issue. Well, I don't ever expect at that, when I was a supervisor, for them to be the ones. Shit rolls downhill in law enforcement, okay? And maybe it does in maybe your worlds as well. I don't know, but
social services, yes, it
yeah,
does.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So it, you know, it does roll downhill, and so I didn't want it resting on that officer. And it was my duty at the time to report that. And so AG's office gets involved, so on and so forth. It gets messy, and just as I suspected, I was on my way out. And so I end up at a crossroads, and I'm going, you know, I haven't had the best of luck or the best go at law enforcement. I mean, I had highlights in my career where I was recognized by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I was recognized by different entities at that high level, that federal level, and it was a good feeling, and I felt like, at the time, like, this is good, I'm here, this is where I'm supposed to be, serving the community, doing all these things. And then, but I feel like at times I knew too much, mm-hmm. and I knew all the wrong things. In law enforcement, we have this thing called blacklisting, and it's illegal, but departments do it, but they do it very well, and to where, you know, they're just not, it's undetectable, or it's hearsay, or, you know, can't be proven. But blacklisting happens all the time to individuals who have tried to do well in law enforcement, but have tried to do it at the expense of somebody at the higher levels, and so they pay the price. I saw myself paying the price far too often at different agencies, and I just thought, okay, this isn't what law enforcement is. This isn't what it was intended for.
It's not what I signed up for either, or I thought I was signing up for.
Right, and so this model of, and I had a love for law enforcement and the people out there going in performing those duties day in and day out, and I still have a respect for them. But the ones who still continue to tarnish it, oh gosh, I have such a dislike for. And it's sad because those officers who have that spotty history or just bad officers, they do get recycled, and they are sort of put in the, they're forgotten because they're so deep in the ranks, and they're there. these officers, people think, oh, these officers have gotten in trouble and they've ended up on the news, that they just go away and they go into other fields. No, they're recycled. They're in the field still. You just don't hear about them. They're
somewhere else.
They're quiet, yeah. You know? And so they get lost in the masses. Yeah. And it's, I thought, I'm at a crossroads. What can I do? My next best option at that time was to just go into a teaching role. I had my instructor certification and I thought, okay, I can teach law enforcement without having to deal with the ranks and deal with the brass and do all that sort of stuff. And so I ended up going to the local school district and teaching active shooter. I was also a resource officer and I was happy doing it, but you do miss the highs of being on the street and supervising guys. And so it just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this is...
No, I keep hearing these little noises, and
your
I'm
house,
like,
your house, yeah. Your house, your spot
it
here.
It's like a living room. No, it's nice though, because I feel like we're in a living room, like this little nook. We're in this cozy living room, and it's nice. And I have to set the scene though too, because so we're sitting here drinking, like, well, I finished mine because I'm a glutton for coffee, but like warm coffee, and it's like kind of overcast outside, and a little windy, love dimly lit. There's some thunder, and I'm like, this is it. This is nice, perfect. Nice. Yeah, this is a perfect setup.
Nice.
Yeah, I love it.
So this is the end of the first part of this interview. There's a lot more to come, but because this one's so long, we'll just have to leave you at a cliffhanger, like at the end of one of those Netflix shows. But we promise the rest of this interview is worth the wait, and will be coming up on the next episode, so stand by. And it goes without saying, thanks so much for your patience, and thanks for listening. What's Up ABQ is back. We have more interviews with lovers, creators, doers, and dreamers of ABQ and beyond. In the meantime, follow us on Instagram and send us a message if you or somebody you know is interested in an interview. And as always, we support ABQ locals free of charge. We love you, ABQ. It's good to be back, and we'll be telling you soon what's up, ABQ.